You're listening to a CJRU podcast. Hello, world, and welcome to Atlas of Resistance. I'm Rocky Petkoff, and on this show, I talk to the grassroots organizers fighting for social, racial, and environmental justice right here in Toronto, about why they fight, how to win, and what you can do to get involved. Today on the program will be my interview with Jennifer Scott, the president of Gig Workers United. As a gig worker herself, Jennifer was part of the union drive dating all the way back to its days as Foodsters United, and we will explore how, in the aftermath of Foodora leaving Canada, the union pivoted to building a union for all gig workers across the country. We will also look at how the union is responding to new threats to the security and well-being of gig workers and explore why, as we begin to emerge from the pandemic, workers across Canada should be paying close attention to the union's calls for fair pay and some of the most basic labor protections. All that and more coming up right here, right now, on Atlas of Resistance. Jennifer, thank you so much for coming on the program today.
I'm so happy to be here, and I'm so happy that folks want to hear about what gig workers are doing.
So yeah, as I mentioned, you actually are a courier yourself, and I'm wondering, how long have you been plying the streets of Toronto as a courier?
I've been delivering food on my bicycle in downtown Toronto for, I think, a little over 4 years now.
And what was the catalyst that actually got you involved in the unionization effort?
When you're working, or when I'm working, I spend a lot of time, whether I want to or not, thinking about the stuff that's messed up that I'm dealing with. This one winter was particularly difficult and bad. I just, you know, going to work, cycling around, delivering things, in my head, I'm just like, this could be so much better. This isn't right, this specific experience or this thing, right? And so one day in the spring or summer, I was delivering, there weren't any deliveries. So I'm at work, I'm not making any money. It's so hot. And I'm sitting on this rock on the side of the street waiting for deliveries. And this courier comes up to me and is talking to me. And like, that's cool. I don't have anything better to do, really. And he's like, are you happy with your work? Are you happy with what's going on? And I'm like, no. And he's asking me more questions. And I'm like, are you talking about a union? And he's like, well, yeah. Would you be into that? And I'm like, yeah, I would. And then it just spiraled after that.
You say it just spiraled, but it kind of spiraled right toward the nexus of the organization, you could say. You're the president of the union now. How did you begin to take steps toward taking on a role of leadership within the organization?
So I was a little bit hesitant at first. I mean, as a gig worker, you don't know your coworkers, but there were like ways to connect online, and there were social and community events. And so I go, like, there was a tax clinic where an accountant here in Toronto taught us about how to do our taxes as self-employed people. And so, like, slowly I started to get involved. And it was actually at the tax clinic, after it was over, a couple of women approached me who were, like, also there. And so they talked to me about this idea of, like, a women and trans committee. And I was like, yes, I want that. That is a way that I could be part of this. There weren't a lot of us. It wasn't as, you know, it wasn't as great as you'd have hoped it would be. And so I like making plans. I like organizing. I went home. I put together this huge, big plan of like how we could make it better. And I approached one of the women that I'd met, and I was like, here, these are my ideas. This is my plan. I think we could get this thing going, and this could be really meaningful and really good for women and trans people who work in gig work, and we could make changes. And they were like, yeah, okay, do it. And so I start working on that. I start getting to know other couriers. And then also I saw that there were other ways that I could help. And just, you know, as time passed and as I did more and more and more, I became more involved.
In our pre-interview, you brought up the mantra of solidarity, not charity, as something really integral to not only the work of the union, but also just the kind of community supports that have been built by couriers and by gig workers to support themselves. So I'm really wondering how is that mantra kind of imbued in this work? How is it reflected?
It's really interesting to me as a gig worker. Like, you know, I think most folks know, you know, gig workers don't have a shared workplace the way that a lot of other workers do. And so reasonably, it would be fairly difficult to like unite us. But as a gig worker, I get to see like a different version of that. Because we are isolated, because our work is set up for us to not succeed, we naturally begin to build community because we need community to get over that and to succeed. So regardless of the existence of like a union or organized gig workers, there will naturally be Facebook groups and group chats where gig workers create community amongst other gig workers they have things in common with to help identify, you know, maybe when it's busy, when it's slow, that there's a glitch in the app and you're not being deactivated, that, you know, there's a problem with the tips, so you should file a complaint and make sure your account is reevaluated so you get the tips you didn't get last week. And so I think this idea of like solidarity and supporting gig workers, supporting each other, it is actually kind of like inherent to our existence. That's what we have created or understood we need to be able to thrive. And then when we have the structure of an organization, it's like, well, how much bigger can we make that?
And I think we'll get on to some of the issues with misclassification later in the show. But I want to ask a question about the aftermath of your first big campaign, and that was when y'all were known as Foodsters United, and you won a landmark decision by the Labor Relations Board, which allowed y'all to formally organize a union. This was followed by what it was, an 89.6% vote in favor of unionization, only for maybe, what, a month later, a couple weeks later, I don't remember the exact timeline. I'm sure you do, to announce that Foodora, oh, they're closing up shop in Canada. Bye-bye. So I'm wondering, what did y'all do to pick up the pieces from this rather violent shock, an unprecedented victory followed by just the company just pulling up stakes and leaving?
So we won the right to unionize on February 25th, and then the pandemic began, and it was in late May that Foodora declared bankruptcy. For a lot of us, there's this like other smaller piece, like there's this piece that I remember that was really important in informing the things that I think you're asking about. And that's that the day that Foodora declared bankruptcy, we got an email. I was in a meeting with a bunch of workers from the union where we were meeting to talk about how we could better connect with workers. And we were, you know, going to leave our meeting and do phone calls and have meetings later that day. And, you know, and then I see this email come in. And I actually like stopped the meeting. I was like, full stop. Did anyone else just get that email? And, you know, so I left the meeting and I'm like, shit, what are we going to do? And I start talking to people. And the immediate reaction is like, oh, no, we can't believe this is happening. We're losing our jobs. And there was a huge shift into there is a massive group of people who work on Foodora who can't get on other apps. And so that there is a huge group of us who don't have an alternative. Later in the night, because of course, you know, no part of me was able to go to bed at my regular time that night, I was on Twitter and the CEO of Delivery Hero, which is the parent company of Foodora, tweeted a celebratory tweet announcing that Delivery Hero was celebrating its most profitable first quarter in its history, which was something around like 115 billion euros. And so it was like that for me that informed a lot of this mutual aid and solidarity. So we have folks who we know are not going to be able to get another job right now. We saw folks immediately trying to get on other apps, which within only a few weeks resulted in a lot of the apps closing the hiring because they've too many workers, reasonable. And so we see this huge, huge, vast amount of people who don't have work in this pandemic. And from like a structural level, how do we put pressure? How do we get a confirmation that people could qualify for CERB for Foodora leaving? How do we begin that support solidarity structurally? And then also, how do we do other stuff amongst ourselves in our community? And so things like Food Share Toronto gave us a bunch of food boxes. You know, when you don't have a job, having food security is really important. But Food Share only delivers to a certain delivery area, right? And a lot of our workers lived outside that delivery area. So we organized gig workers who had lost their jobs, gig workers who now were trying to figure out how to work on other apps, organized our own little delivery service of volunteers delivering food boxes to other couriers, people we've never met before, making sure that everyone stays fed as much as we can. And it was during that time that we were able to open the ballot box and see how many of us voted for the union. And we got like the actual certification, like the you've a certified local, you won certificate, while also dealing with like no job in a pandemic and food insecurity and fear. And I don't think there was a single one of us who was like, I've got that certificate and I'm ready to just walk away from it. You know, like that was just not an option.
For what you're building with Gig Workers United is really extending on the work you did with Food Surge United by expanding the scope out from just Foodora couriers in the city of Toronto to really being any gig worker anywhere in the country. And I'm wondering, what sort of transformation has that required?
Part of what I think is interesting about that is like from the point of view of being a gig worker and having conversations with gig workers. I think sometimes when you don't have very much, it's really easy to see a big future, because any change would be a big change. And so what are we going to do? Are we just going to go back to work and not have a union? Fuck no. We're going to create a bigger union. And what is our union going to do? We're going to protect gig workers. We're going to fight for gig workers' rights. So who are gig workers? And immediately we're like, everybody. Who cares what app they work for? Who cares how they work? Who cares what city they work in? We're all in the same position. We're all struggling in the same way. And we're all lacking the same rights. And we're all up against the same fight. So why not unite all of us, as many of us as want to be here? Because we all deserve workers' rights.
How much success have you had in pushing out the boundaries? Have you seen the little sprouts of organizing begin to sprout up, either in other people who, you know, drive for like Uber, other sort of types of apps, or in other localities?
I mean, most of us work for as many apps as we can. And like Foodora's departure is a really good reason as to why. I mean, also the fact that you can get deactivated just, you know, with no recourse and stuff like that, right? So us gathering together and being like, you know, whatever workplace you work in, whatever city you work in, I think is also a really simple kind of transition for us, because we're like, well, you know, I work on Uber, so of course I work DoorDash. We are, by nature of like trying to succeed in this industry, we are all required to be part of almost every aspect of it. And so it is really easy to reach and connect with other gig workers, especially during the pandemic or coming out of the pandemic, because we've been essential workers and essential workers without any rights or protections. And we were a lot of the time essential workers that were talked about in media, talked about even when the province would say, we're going into a lockdown, but food delivery will still exist. We're like, that's us. People know that we are working, but there's nowhere for us to go to the bathroom, or we don't get any priority to vaccines, or there's no financial support if we get sick. It's pretty easy to talk to people about having a better workplace and working together collectively to have a better workplace when you've worked through what are just really, really horrendous working conditions.
What's the day-to-day work that you and your fellow organizers do to keep the union running day in and day out?
I mean, so the majority of the work that I do on a day-to-day basis is just talking to other people, which is great because I love to talk and I love people. But these are heavy conversations, talking about gig work and about the dehumanization that we experience at work requires us to confront a lot of things. The fact that our rent is so high, the fact that the cost of groceries keeps going up, but our wages keep going down. The fact that we have our job means that we have no money put aside for retirement or sick days, that we get hurt at work, and they're very serious injuries. These are actually really heavy conversations that ask us to reevaluate not only the consequences of our job and the conditions that we work in, but also the sort of broader society or world that we live in. Love having those conversations. Love building relationships with my coworkers and my comrades, because it really does extend past just being a coworker. But also, they're heavy and they're hard. And that's, I think, maybe just part of what life is like for all of us right now. But when I'm not talking to folks, the work that I do and that a lot of us do is around connecting folks with each other. how do we provide information about stuff we learn about, like the fact that Toronto City Council has voted unanimously on integrating some supports that exist in other cities like Ottawa to provide relief for parking tickets for drivers. This process to create a relief system for that is huge. It will have significant consequences for the income of drivers. So how do we connect drivers with that knowledge? And to some degree, like, who cares if they even support workers working collectively or if they even understand or know about the union? Like, who even cares? How do we just make sure they have the tools they need to not struggle while they're working? And so, like, newsletters and outreach and social media and getting out on the street with flyers and talking to workers and connecting workers with knowledge, connecting workers with the union, but also, you know, what do you need to make your life better? Because guaranteed, it's probably pretty hard.
In your efforts, do you feel like you've had to reinvent the playbook when it comes to strategy?
I feel informed by my knowledge of the history of working class people and working class people fighting for unions or fighting for workers' rights. And I think a lot about some of the early workers who fought for those things. And late 1800s, early 1900s, they didn't have big unions like we do now. You know, they didn't have CUPW the way that we do, having their back and helping to, like, get them at the table or making sure those tables even exist and helping them negotiate or access resources. Like, that didn't exist. They were just workers who got together, who said, like, we know our work, we know our industry, we know what we need for it to be better, and we can see the paths that exist to get there. And so, like, together, we're gonna use all of the resources, all of the knowledge, all of the experience from our lives to figure out the best way to make that happen. And, you know, I mean, like, for me, at the end of that, what that turns into is when workers gather and unite together, regardless of what they're up against, if they work collectively, if they talk to each other, figure things out, problem solve collectively, they'll know what to do and it'll work.
We're having this conversation at what appears to be an inflection point here in North America and really in Ontario, where groups like yours are pushing to have greater access to the labor protections that many of us take for granted. Companies like Lyft and Uber aren't just content to keep classifying also independent contractors, but are pushing for this new third classification of worker. In Ontario, this is being branded as FlexPlus. And I think this has really gone under the radar. So before we get into looking at how this is going to be brought about and what the process is, could you really just shed some light on exactly what Uber and Lyft and their kind are proposing?
Platform employers are pushing for the creation of a third category of worker. And so, you know, what that means is, like, in Ontario, we have two classifications of worker. We have independent contractor and we have dependent contractor and employee. And dependent contractor is not quite an employee, but still classified as a type of employee. And the things that, you know, the rights, protections, things that you're entitled to as a worker are dependent on your classification. And so the idea of a third classification of worker is this worker that's entitled to some minimal rights and then not entitled to others, and oftentimes not entitled to all of the ones with teeth, the important ones. So FlexPlus means that Uber promises me that they will give me some money for my retirement, some money for sick days, some money for dental, but I will, you know, how much money I get and is vague and unknown to me. That money will be held by Uber instead of deposited into, say, like, my CPP. And I'd have to choose between all of those things. So I'd have to choose between, like, taking a sick day or putting money away for my retirement. That's really pretty much all I get from it. You know, really what it is, what I lose. I lose access to regulated programs like EI, CPP, WSIB. I lose the right to unionize. In Canada, everybody has the right to unionize. If you're an independent contractor, you have to do like what we did with Foodora. You have to prove that you're not an independent contractor, but you're entitled to the right to do that. Under a third category, we would lose that. And that doesn't exist right now here, that workers have the right to organize, to try to fight for better rights if they want them, if they qualify for them, is a really important tenet of our labor laws. And we would lose that. For the first time ever, we'd have a group of people who have some rights and not all, and most importantly, do not have the right to try and make their workplace better. I think that's really dangerous. It is one of the most regressive pieces of labor policy I have ever seen. And I think it's deeply frightening because it's not like a third category that only applies to people who work Uber. This is a change to the labor laws to create a third category of worker within the framework of worker classification. And so like earlier in the interview, Rocky, you were like, maybe I have more protections at work than you do, but there would be nothing stopping your employer from terminating folks under your classification and rehiring people as third category who don't have rights. And I think that's why folks should care about this and folks should know about this. The people who are holding the line and fighting against it are gig workers, because we are the people who immediately will be classified into it. But 2 years, 3 years, 5 years after it becomes law, how many workers in Ontario or Canada will work under a third category without very basic and very necessary protections that have been long held and long fought for by people? Every labor law that exists, every labor reform that exists, was fought by workers who died for those things. And this is to regress away from that. There's a really old labor song called Bread and Roses. And it's really important to me. And it's like a song written by women for women who are like union organizing or pro union work, you know, that sort of thing. But in it, there's a verse about recognizing and speaking for the voices of women who died at work. And this idea that many women have died at work, and so we do this, we march, we fight, we organize, we win rights and protections. We also know that those women are people in the same way that we are, and that they lived human lives where they witnessed and loved and experienced art and beauty and life and ate bread and had roses and died at work so that companies could profit. And so we will not stand for that. We will march. In the GTA, we don't see a lot of gig worker death. It's something that I am deeply grateful for. But in other cities in the world, that is not the case. And delivery people being killed on their deliveries, delivery people dying on the road because of collisions, delivery people dying from COVID is incredible and immense and in very high numbers in other cities and other countries. And so I feel something similar to what they're talking about in that song.
As I alluded to in my last question, Flex Plus is something currently under consideration by the Ontario government. I'm wondering, what's the current status of that proposal before the government?
So labor laws they vary ever so slightly province to province. So, you know, I mean, this proposal was put forward to every provincial government by Uber, and every provincial government will make a decision on it. It appears that Ontario is the first, and Ontario will be the first to make a statement, you know, especially when we take a look at like Uber's pattern of like how they subvert laws. That's what they do. Like to go back, maybe to look at that pattern, like to go back to 2016 when Uber first came to Canada doing like rideshare, the way that they wanted to operate, you know, violated laws for like taxi requirements, and so they put forward their requests to be able to operate outside of the law or change the law, whatever version of that was, depending on the area, independently to each municipality, to each province, you know, and looked to find wins where they could. And over time, because like Quebec was a province that really held out and was like, nope, not going to happen. But Uber won the fight in BC, even though BC did have a really strong fight back, won that real easy in Ontario. Ontario was just like, well, sure, and eventually won that in Quebec too. And so their pattern is to sort of target and atomize government in the same way they do workers into small individual groups. Take a win, get a win where you can, where it's easy, where it'll come quick, and then use that as like proof that people or governments or, you know, places that are holding out should also agree to something similar. And so what happens in Ontario, I think, really matters and will likely inform what happens in other provinces. And so we, the workers, and we, the people, have to fight back, and we have to say no, 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 full stop. These are our protections. These are our rights. We spend the vast majority of our lives at work. We spend more time with our coworkers than we do with the people we love. And we are not going to go to work and die. We are not going to go to work and have no ability to hold our employer accountable for egregious things like wage theft or health and safety violations. We deserve better.
So I want to contrast kind of this this vision of the future put forward by companies like Uber, companies like Lyft, companies like DoorDash, etc., with really the core demand of what y'all are putting forward. And I know in the intro to the show, I skimmed over your demands at a very high level, but I'm wondering if you could just go into some more detail about just the sorts of things that you and your fellow couriers are asking for.
Yeah, so when I go to work, regardless of the app, I log in, I'm ready to work. You know, I have my bike, I have my lunch in my bag, I'm ready. And I don't get paid until I accept a delivery and I am at the restaurant. Like, to give you a really good day-to-day example, I usually log in around Queen and Spadina. Say my first delivery is to pick up at a restaurant at College in Ossington. I don't get paid for how long I was waiting at Queen and Spadina before I got an order. I don't get paid to travel from Queen and Spadina to College in Ossington, and I don't get paid to wait at that restaurant for the food to be ready. But I was working the whole time. I was on my shift. I was logged in, but I don't get paid for that. Then when I get my delivery, I get paid to deliver from the restaurant to the person. And, you know, there are some variables there as to like how much and how it breaks down. But generally speaking, that's what I get paid to do. If I'm delivering to a condo, like say like the ICE condos, and like no shade to like ICE condos, they're really big, they're really popular, but their elevators are always broken. And so like a 10-15 minute wait for an elevator to go up and down is really common, and I don't get paid for that. You know, my wage doesn't increase because I was doing my job and I'm just out that time. If that's my shift, College in Spadina is where I log in, Queen and Ossington to pick up delivery at the ICE condos. Maybe that takes like half an hour, 45 minutes. And right now I could get paid between $3 and maybe a max of like $5 for that. So better pay, a wage floor.
Yeah.
This idea that like I am logged in, I am working, I should be paid. Which is fairly simple. This idea that the amount of money that I make per hour should absolutely be in line with minimum wage. There is a reason that we have a minimum wage. People cannot live off of $6 or $9 per hour. On top of that are, and that's where we get into like workers' rights and workers' protections. And so to break that down again, maybe into day-to-day examples, say for that order, it came in and I was told that I'd get paid $4.50 for that order. And then, you know, later in the day, I'm at home, I'm looking at my app, I'm calculating how much I earned, and I see that I got paid $3.50 for that. And like, maybe I took a screenshot of it when it came in, maybe I didn't. I know that I was told I'd get paid more. So I can open a ticket in the app and I can say, hey, like when it came in, I was told it'd be $4.50, got paid $3.50. Can you take a look at this? You know, explain what happened. If I have a screenshot, I can send that. If I don't, I don't. And they'll say, yeah, for sure. We'll look into that. Absolutely. And then you can come back to an answer. And this is very common where they'll say, hey, absolutely. We looked into it. We reevaluated it. You are right. You were not paid correctly. Unfortunately though, you're saying you should have been paid $4.50. You got paid $3.50. When we reevaluated it, the correct price for this delivery is actually $2.50. So we've corrected your pay in the app and you'll now be paid $2.50. And then it will close. So like I can see this text messaging conversation. I can see that little bar that I should tap where I can type and I can say, hey, hold up. But I cannot type in it. Like my ability to continue the conversation fully ends. And I can't do anything more about it. If I tried to create a new ticket and reference that ticket, they'd be like, but that ticket was resolved. My ability to hold my employer, my app, accountable for things is zero. And so like that's the accountability that they provide to me. My ability legally to like go to court and say, hey, I've experienced wage theft. Wage theft is a recognized, you know, violation of workers' rights. And there are tools and procedures set up to identify and demonstrate that it happens and then, you know, seek reconciliation for the worker. I don't even have that either because I'm an independent contractor and I have no right. When I talk about rights and protections for gig workers, I mean things like the ability to hold our employer accountable for things because we have been shown that the employer is not willing to be accountable. the ability to arbitrate things with somebody who knows what they're doing. So like part of having a union is that the union knows how to, has resources, has experience going to court and dealing with things like wage theft or discrimination or deactivation, like unlawful termination of your job. The union knows how to do that. And so in an industry where the employer intentionally hires en masse migrant workers, newcomers, international students, and racialized people of color who are low income, they're doing that intentionally. They're hiring people who they think don't have the ability to take them to court to arbitrate. The union and having a union means that you as an individual do not have to be a lawyer. You do not have to know how courts work in Canada. You have a whole crew of people who can help you with that. And so like in an industry where we see the employers target vulnerable people, we need that second or other really big protection of the ability to unionize, if that's what we want to do, the ability to have a union who can have our back, who can help us negotiate. And so then that's the big one. In a lot of jobs, you have the ability to negotiate your contract. You have the ability to negotiate a pay increase. You have the ability to, when your employer says, hey, we've made a unilateral decision that we are cutting your pay during a pandemic, say, no, that's not what our contract says. We don't have any of that right now. We don't have a joint health and safety board, which many of your listeners, I'm sure, have in their workplace. We don't have sick days. We don't have any liability if we're injured at work. We don't have the ability to demand something like WSIB, which is minimal protection in an injury at work. Those bigger, like sort of high level, what are workers' rights and protections are, they all just kind of bundle into the ability to hold our employer accountable for the really egregious things that have been and are happening in our day-to-day lives. And, you know, sort of part of the reason that Flex Plus is so hard on you can't unionize, you can't organize, is because that's what they're trying to do. They already have demonstrated they don't want to be accountable to workers. And so how to take away the only tool for accountability that workers have.
So basically, and I think I've said this before and you've said this before, but what y'all are fighting for are really just the sort of basic labor protections that so many Ontarians take for granted.
Frustrating for me when we have conversations like when gig workers are talking, or when like with each other, or when we're talking with, you're just like other folks in general, how basic the things are that we're talking about. To go back to the pandemic for a minute, like we didn't have access to bathrooms, and I definitely feel like sympathy for restaurants. You know, I get that no one really knew how to protect themselves or their workers. And so, you know, where they're saying like, we want to have the fewest number of people possible coming in a bathroom, this space where we can't like see if you're washing your hands, see if you're wearing your mask. Like I get that. At the same time though, apps have partnerships with really big corporate restaurants where those restaurants don't pay fees because they're so big, where apps could have made arrangements that financially benefited everyone and that allowed workers to use the bathroom, but they didn't. And so the consequence of that was we have a worker who has a really severe and critically threatening bladder infection. We have a number of workers who purchased adult diapers. A number of workers who would carry water bottles in their cars so they could go to the bathroom in the car. I work on a bike, so I couldn't do that. So I'd go to the bathroom in alleyways. And on more than one occasion, I'd have like strange men that I don't know approach me while I'm trying to go to the bathroom in this alley. And it feels very dangerous and very unsafe and like just deeply dehumanizing. You know, like in general, I think the narrative of the app's push of like, what is a gig worker is dehumanizing. And that's just part of the narrative. That's part of what makes it successful and not real workers, which is just gig workers. It's just a gig, you know, but that's sort of what it culminates in, these very basic protections, very basic rights that largely on a day-to-day basis would serve to make us feel less dehumanized. And I think that is so, so deeply wrong.
One of the common threads in so many of the depictions of gig work that I've read in preparing for this piece is this feeling of invisibility that so many gig workers often feel as they're plying the streets, as they're making deliveries. And I'm wondering if you can kind of shed some light on what that actually feels like to live and experience.
So like as a woman, if I want to go out into the world and not have men that I don't know hit on me or try and take me home or even just like say rude things to me, I just dress like a bike courier, because if I look like a bike courier, nobody will notice me. People won't look at me, and I can walk through, you know, down a busy street or through a busy building and nobody will see me. It's like I'm not there. And I think that's the day-to-day reality for a lot of us. And there are so many nuanced layers that get added to that. As woman bike courier, I experience a lot of gendered violence while I'm cycling. And so nobody sees me and knows me that I'm here and acknowledges my existence. But also at the same time, because I'm taking space on the road, you know, people tell me that they're going to kill me. It's just a real wild way to interact with the community. When we get into that sort of the narrative of the gig economy and the narrative that dehumanizes gig workers, I think that's really interesting. And I think it's strategic. You know, apps have done a really good job of saying, like, these people are not real workers. That's why they're not employees. It's just a gig. It's just, you know, it's just nothing really for them. It doesn't matter if they have rights. You know, there was a time, if there are folks who are listening who've been ordering on Uber Eats for a long time, there was a time in Toronto where Uber Eats used to say, don't tip them. They don't need tips. We pay them. Don't worry about it. You know, and now because the apps know that you will tip, they pay us less. I think, again, that the primary goal of the gig economy is to make profit by disrupting labor practices. And a tool to do that is to change the way that people look at the workers. The workers don't need labor rights. They don't need labor protection. So it's okay if we disrupt them. And I think as consumers, as people, as policymakers, what we have to do is pull back that veil, because it's really what it is. It's a way to hide the malicious goals that are being done sort of quietly, like Flex Plus, is hidden under this veil of flexibility. And if you pull back that veil that is dehumanizing, that veil flexibility or misclassification, you know, whatever version of it is that you're trying to look behind, I think what you see is the reality of huge, huge international corporations inviting you to look at other human beings who are working, and not see them as human beings in the same way that you see yourself. And so through complicity, co-sign something that is going to make you precarious. I do not think that it is a coincidence that Flex Plus comes right on the heels of the end of the COVID-19 pandemic. Socially, our province, our community is precarious. We don't know what the economy is going to be like. We don't know what jobs are going to be like. We don't even really know what normal or going back to work will look like. And while we are trying to figure that out and we feel uncertain, Uber is stepping in with Flex Plus, this massive change, and veiling that under, well, it's necessary because we're coming out of the pandemic. It's necessary because workers need flexibility because of the pandemic. In whatever ways you can, in whatever ways you're able to, pulling back that veil and looking at the real people behind it who are doing their job and trying to pay their bills is, I think, the best way to combat that.
Do you feel like yourself and your fellow gig workers, with the work you've done with this union or even outside of it, have you been able to create a shift in how people perceive the work that you do and not have it just be dismissed as something casual?
On a policy level, obviously there is a lot of work to be done. And if the work had been successful, we wouldn't maybe see Flex Plus being considered, right? But on like a community level, I absolutely think that the vast majority of people who use apps want to use apps in a way that's ethical. They want to use apps in a way that doesn't make them feel like they're contributing to something horrible. As an example, we do this thing called order in days. So if you are down with what we're doing, if you support this work, what you can do is get this packet from us that will, you know, help you do it successfully. But when you place an order on the app, you would then try and create some time to talk to the person who's delivering to you and listen to their voice, listen to their story if they're willing to tell you, and also tell them that you see them, you recognize them, you support what they are doing. doing and what is happening, and you can help connect them with their coworkers. And so, like, for me, there have been times when when somebody did that with me, you know, and I'm like, oh, I know what you're doing. Like, thank you. But then also at the same time, I'm like, you know, I'm delivering. I'm not making as much money as I need to. You know, maybe I have to work an extra 2 or 3 hours today because there weren't enough orders, or they paid so low. It's cold or it's really hot and I don't feel good. And for this brief moment, this person is saying to me, like, I recognize you as a human being. I recognize that you are struggling and I care about you. And that is hugely meaningful. I think in general, courier work is a form of care work. The pandemic makes that really easy to see. We delivered food or groceries to people during the pandemic so that they could stay home. We took care of people by allowing them to stay home and take care of themselves and their families. And so in this moment where somebody who I'm delivering to cares for me by recognizing my humanity or recognizing my struggle or my work, it feels immense. Especially like sort of in contrast to the fact that the industry that I work in cultivates my feeling dehumanized.
Mm-hmm. And I'd also imagine that the community supports, really the community that you've built with other couriers, other gig workers, we've talked about earlier in the show, also goes a way to help not feeling completely alone and invisible.
Yeah, definitely. There's nothing like having a coworker who's just like, I see your work, you did a good job.
10 years down the line, and I know this is a hard question, but what do you imagine we will see when we look at what y'all have built at Gig Workers United?
When I talk about the Food Stars United campaign, and I mean like us too, but I talk about us less sort of in like past pretenses. We were audacious in this way that's like beautiful and amazing, and I love it. And so what I see for the short term is this group of vibrant, capable people who are primarily migrant workers, racialized people, low-income people, women, trans people, who are holding the line against regressive labor policy for everybody in this country. And that is amazing, and we do it with audacity and commitment and so much more just teeth than I think anybody realizes. And so when I think about the future, I have no idea where we will be with gig work or the union in the future, but I hope that 50 or 60 years from now, when we look back on this period of time, I hope that we see that a huge, huge group of people who had the audacity to envision a path to the future that is better than the one they are on now cut their teeth fighting gig employers and app employer and left that space to go on to create more change, more growth, more commitment to a better future than currently exists. And I am so excited to be part of that and to see what we will do, because I think the possibilities are so much bigger than I can even imagine.
I really wish I could end the show on that note, because that would be such an amazing way to end the show, but I can't. The way I run the show says I can't, and I have to ask one final question. That is, what is your call to action?
Absolutely. So the province of Ontario has set up a consultation. And so consultation process is open to anybody. And it's a consultation process on the future of gig work. And this would be the group of people who evaluate Uber's Flex Plus and who create the proposal that is then brought forward on it. And so the consultation process closes for submissions on July the 12th, which is incredibly short and frankly unheard of. The last time that the province did a consultation on work, it lasted for 2 years. And this one will be open for just under 4 weeks, which I think is, So you can submit to that. You can submit to that consultation. You can say, I do not support the regressive labor policy that is Flex Plus or a third category of worker. You can participate in actions that uplift gig workers' voices. You can listen and learn from and then share the videos, the interviews, the articles that we write, that we film, that we are part of. You can donate to our hardship fund to help us stay on the road and take care of each other. You can participate in something like order in days, where you ensure that a worker gets a decent tip and talks to someone who gives a shit about them. put up a poster. We have them. You can have one. Put up a poster in your window, in your car, in your office, saying that you support us. Come to our rallies. Come to our events. Almost every week we have a tent that we put up in downtown or midtown Toronto, and we try and reach workers and engage with workers. Drop by, you know, if you feel like you can, bring some coffee or some donuts. If you can't, just say hi. Help us connect with each other and help us be heard.
What about if someone listening to this program is a gig worker themselves?
And you should join the union. Send us an email or go to the website. There's like a there's a form on our website, gigworkersunited.ca. And if you fill it out, somebody like me will give you a call and talk to you and talk to you about how to connect. You know, if you like using social media, if you like using Twitter or Instagram, you can do the same by reaching us there. If you see us out on the street, say hi. Connect in any way that works for you. But join. Talk to us. Even if you feel a little uncertain, part of having collective voices work together for a better future is those voices representing all of us. You know, I know a lot of workers who are struggling. I know a lot of workers who feel the way I do. Maybe you don't have the exact same experience. Maybe you are uncertain. You should still be here. Your voice still matters. Your experiences help shape a more nuanced, more thoughtful, and better version of the future.
Jennifer, thank you so much for coming on the program today.
Thank you so much for having me. And to the folks who are listening, thank you for caring and for supporting, being part of the work that we're doing.
Anyway, that was Jennifer Scott, the president of Gig Workers United and a food courier herself. If you're keen on learning more about Gig Workers United, you can find them online at gigworkersunited.ca. You can also check them out on social media. They're on Instagram at Gig Workers United and on Twitter at Gig Workers Unite. And of course, you can drop them an electronic dispatch at info@gigworkersunited.ca.
As we go marching, marching.
Now, for those who missed the announcement last time, this will be the last episode of Atlas of Resistance for this first run of episodes. With summer beginning to heat up, I just want to take a break from the regular grind of releasing episodes every couple of weeks and all the work that that entails. And I also want to take time to reflect on these first 12 episodes so that when the show comes back in the fall, it will be so much stronger. As for the music you've heard this episode, for the intro you heard Hot Corner by the Katsumi Hori Project, and you are currently listening to Bread and Roses by Don Landis, Alana Amaram, and Abigail Chapin. Now, if you'll indulge me for just 1 minute, I would like to leave you with a call to action of my very own. I've gone through and listened to the calls to action for each of the groups featured on this show this season, and the common thread through so many of them was just to talk to your neighbors and let the people in your life know that you're willing to stand in solidarity with them. And remember, though, that even the smallest actions can speak louder than the most impassioned speeches. So there's a whole world of injustice out there, so let's roll up our sleeves and get to work. So until the fall, I've been Rocky Petkoff, and I'll see you in the streets.
It is bread we fight for, but we fight for roses too. As we go marching, marching, we're standing proud and tall. The rising of the women means the rising of us all. No more the drudge and idler, and the toil where one reposes, but a sharing of life's glories. Bread and roses, bread and roses. Our starve as well as bodies, give us bread, but give us roses. Bread and roses, bread.